I will say for companies with a little bit more complex clinical trial work in front of them, even if you have the opportunity to become commercial, if there's not a meaningful reimbursement, you're probably going to waste money. And you run the danger of, you know, people running out using the device for something that it wasn't your best shot on goal. And then you end up, you know, with out in the marketplace or a data set that ends up out there presented at a meeting that really doesn't behoove what you're up to.
Welcome to MedSider, where you can learn from the brightest founders and CEOs in medical devices and health technology. Join tens of thousands of ambitious doers as we unpack the insights, tactics, and secrets behind the most successful life science startups in the world. Now, here's your host, Scott Nelson.
Hey everyone, it's Scott. In this episode of MedSider, I sat down with Trent Rudiman, CEO of Mercator Med Systems. Trent has over 25 years of leadership experience in med tech, including roles in sales, marketing, and business development, with a focus on minimally invasive interventional products for companies like iDev, Rox Medical, Rita Med Systems, Guidant, and Cordis. Here are a few of the key things that we discussed in this conversation. First, clinical and commercial efforts are always a balancing act. You need to demonstrate your technology's efficacy by gathering solid data for regulatory approval and reimbursement. However, you also need to constantly improve upon the design and usability of your device. Embrace the fact that the initial product may not be perfect, but if it achieves the right outcomes, you can refine it over time. Second, be willing to reassess and shift your focus, especially when facing challenging scenarios or strong competition. Don't hesitate to reposition your product to meet emerging needs or enter less crowded markets. Embrace change as an opportunity to prove the versatility of your technology. Third, treat your product and market with care. Be selective about who you sell to, especially if your technology requires a learning curve in order to preserve its efficacy. Know your position in the market and articulate it clearly. Remember, a quick no is always better than a slow maybe. All right, before we jump into this episode, I wanted to let you know that the latest edition of MedSider Mentors is now live. We just published Volume 5, which summarizes the key learnings from the most popular MedSider interviews over the last several months with incredible entrepreneurs like Gabriel Jones, CEO of Proprio, Kirsten Carroll, CEO of Can Do Health, Dr. David Alpert, founder of AliveCor, Greg Bullington, CEO of Magnolia Medical, and other leaders of some of the hottest startups in our space. Look, it's tough to listen or read every interview that comes out, even the best ones, but there are so many valuable lessons you can pick up from the founders and CEOs that join our program. So that's why we decided to create MedSider Mentors. It's the easiest way for you to learn from the world's best medical device and health technology entrepreneurs in one central place. To check out the latest volume, head over to MedSiderRadio.com/mentors. Premium members get free access to all past and future volumes. If you're not a premium member yet, you should definitely consider signing up. In addition to every volume of MedSider Mentors, you'll get full access to the entire library of interviews dating back to 2010. You'll also be able to see all of our playbooks, which are handpicked collections of the most insightful interviews with the brightest founders and CEOs that join our program. Whether you're looking to master capital fundraising, navigate early stage development, tackle regulatory challenges, understand reimbursement, or position your venture for a meaningful exit, MedSider playbooks have you covered. And last, considering that fundraising can be one of the most daunting tasks for any startup, we created a meticulous database of investors right at your fingertips. Explore a wealth of VC funds, private equity firms, angel groups, and more, all eager to invest in medical device and health technology startups. Access to this database is a premium member exclusive, so don't miss out. Learn more about MedSider Mentors and our premium memberships by visiting MedSiderRadio.com/mentors. All right, without further ado, let's jump into the interview. All right, Trent, welcome to MedSider Radio. Appreciate you coming on.
Hey, Scott, thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, I know we're both working on companies in similar types of arenas, so to speak. So this should be a fun conversation, and we may get a little bit more into the weeds than maybe I otherwise do. So with that said, I recorded a very brief bio, a little bit more of a professional bio on your background at the outset of this interview. But I always like to start here, right? Hear it kind of from you first. If there's like sort of an elevator style pitch on kind of what you've been doing leading up to the last, over a decade now with Mercator, I think. Let's start there.
Well, okay, great. My background really is, you know, been a path through sales and marketing. And most of those companies, you know, have been focused on minimally invasive and then oftentimes interventional procedures. That started for me, you know, back in the field and then carried through all the way to executive leadership. I would say, you know, about 15 years ago, I consciously made a decision, though, to try to move into a little bit earlier stage and really get involved in companies that were, you know, either needed to or wanted to generate data and some sort of outcomes around their products. It was becoming clear to me as I was looking forward, I don't think just plain market access was really just going to be enough. And so, you know, very rare now are the days of just a 510K approval gets you there. You know, we might argue that, you know, if you had a strong reimbursement path, maybe you don't need quite as much data. But I made a conscious decision to try to get involved in projects that were building data sets and really had stuff to back the technology and the outcome up.
That's good. I'm looking at some of the companies, and for those that are in the cardiovascular space, I mean, you recognize some of these names, right? CSI, Rox Medical, iDev, obviously Mercator's been working on this for the better part of a decade. So really, really, really kind of cool background. Let's learn a little bit more about the Bullfrog, right? And what you're, sure. You know, where it's kind of positioned today, and then we'll go back in time and kind of double click into some of these kind of functional areas that we like to cover in these interviews. But give us a sense for the Bullfrog, and maybe explain it as if like people listening aren't overly familiar with the interventional space, right? Like how is this used? What is the device? How are physicians using this device today?
Well, you know, the product name is the Bullfrog. It's really a catheter-based system. And the whole concept is around micro-infusion. Okay, and so micro-infusion, which is what we kind of brand what we're doing, is this unique ability to locally deliver targeted therapeutics in an aqueous form, so they're liquid, during catheter-based interventions, you know, in diseases with unresolved needs. And so, you know, not a new concept, right? It's this graduation beyond mechanical therapy, whether arterial, whether on the venous side. And, you know, certainly there's a lot of precedence. Local drug delivery, most people think about it as kind of in the coronary was drug-eluting stents, you know, that carried over into the peripheral space, more on a balloon platform because less stenting was being done just due to the anatomy. You know, and now we're kind of the next natural evolution of that. And what microinfusion does for you that's different is it just provides this unique efficiency that's so different because we're not dependent on a surface-coated drug, you know, onto a stent or a balloon. And so, you know, all kinds of things like, you know, not releasing drug until you have the catheter exactly where you want it. The dosing is much more controllable. You can add contrast to the drug and actually get a visualization, an imaging of where the drug's going. You know, just those kind of things were what really attracted me to this opportunity. You know, and then it really has played itself out, and we'll get into this for a number of different reasons, you know, because we've been around for a while, but we're executing on, you know, several different applications or indications, validating the platform.
Got it. And for those listening, we'll, of course, link to Mercator's website in the full summary article on MedCiter. But if you don't get to that that particular piece, it's mercatormed.com. So M-E-R-C-A-T-O-R, mercatormed.com is the website where you can learn a little bit more about the technology as well as just, you know, what, the, you know, sort of some of the latest you know, clinical work that Trent and his team have been working on. And so with that said, you know, Mercator is such an interesting story, right? Because typically a company that's been around for 10 years, you think, what's going on? It hasn't exited yet. There's you know, it hasn't IPO'd, but yet you're still cranking, right? Still producing clinical data. I'm looking at even some of the releases from Veins at the kind of the Viva Veins conference this past fall. So give us a sense kind of for like where you're at now. Where's the company at now? Kind of what are you focused on maybe over the next, you know, 12 months or so?
Yeah, well, the company remains in a clinical development phase where, you know, we're having to produce data to actually secure an indication. And so, you know, that's been the state of affairs. What really changed is we were headed that way in the arterial space. We actually got a data set to publication, but we got there after drug-coated balloon. And I think the drug-coated balloon ran away so fast, you know, we were kind of thinking, do we go up against, you know, a Bard who had acquired Lutonix? Do we go up against Medtronic? And it just there were a lot of physicians who had used the product and they had taken it below the knee. And so we came to an ultimate conclusion that it made more sense, to go below the knee and to jump on a newer version of the drug and get to Limus quickly. And so ironically, right, we did a first study with dexamethasone because the device is so efficient, just treating the inflammation, at the site, even on the arterial side, produced data that looked a lot like DCB, but we just got there, about 18 or 24 months after. So then our first incremental step then on the arterial side was, well, let's deliver Limus. Paclitaxel wasn't working below the knee. Nobody had made it through a successful study. And by the way, that hasn't changed. Nothing has made it through to approval. So, kind of in the 2017, 2018, early 2019 timeframe, we did a phase two randomized study. And this will come up when we talk about regulatory path, why I call it a phase two. The drug is doing the work here. We have a device approval for delivering drug. What we're really trying to do is create a new indication for a drug that's already out there. And so, interestingly enough, we did a randomized study and we got really incredible results. We had a big differentiation between the treatment and the control. And Little Mercator was the first company to do randomized clinical trial work in the US, on a Limus solution for below the knee interventions. And so we were all set. Phase two data looked good. We had a corporate partner that was very interested heading into early 2020. We, of course, need to do a phase three study. It would be similar to an IDE trial on the device side. And we had that all lined up, and along comes COVID, right? And so COVID really put that work on hold. We weren't going to enroll a 400-patient study during COVID. People didn't want to finance that. Big companies were looking internally. And so, we were really sitting there in early 2020 saying, gosh, we're in a tough spot. I'm glad we don't have the money because I wouldn't have wanted to have been pressed to try to make it happen. I think there were companies that started enrolling early in COVID and their clinical data came out more challenging for that. But where we have a platform and where we were fortunate and why we remain in clinical development, and you referenced something as early or most recent as veins, is we had a lot of users that work on both sides, on the arterial and the venous side, and came back to us and said, hey, despite COVID, the venous side is cranking. There's a lot going on in venous, and we really like the work you did with the anti-inflammatory steroid. Could you bring it back? And so it was an easy pivot. So we've reproduced some phase two work now on the venous side, and really, it's probably a little bit more spot on for the drug. DVT and VTE is much more inflammation-based than it is cell proliferation and scarring. And so we were able to lean on some of the early work we did with dexamethasone. We cranked out a bigger version of the device that fit better for veins, and we were up and running really quick. We had extended the 510K to cover the venous device, and all of a sudden we found ourselves, while it was in COVID, all of a sudden we were working in the hot part of the field in DVT and VTE where things were cranking along. And so it's been fun to highlight if there was an upside to COVID, and there aren't many. For us, it unlocked the real platform capability of the technology.
Got it. That's super, super helpful explanation and a classic story of what's required, right, in a startup is being flexible and nimble and to kind of see where the market's sort of like pulling you in essence, right, or pushing you and kind of to move in that
Absolutely.
direction. So just so I'm clear, is the company primarily focused on the venous space right now, or are you kind of pushing forth clinical efforts on both, or just venous for the time being?
Yeah, no, I think, with the backdrop in Venus, right, we got a lot of attention. Being the first company to be able to bring drug delivery to the venous space. And we're far out in front of the others now. And, really, if you can't deliver the drug aqueously, you don't have a means, you're not going to be able to get enough steroid on a balloon or a stent. And so unlike the PAD space, we really have this drug delivery application to ourselves. So it's garnered a lot of attention, and that's good. I mean, if you look at the backdrop for fundraising today, it's great to have a home run, and it's great that there's, a lot of corporate consideration And there's been a lot of tuck-ins in Venus. So yeah, I would say right now we're first and foremost a Venus company. That said, more capital and more resources. We have a phase three BTK study basically approved from the agency. It's got great data behind it. And so, maybe with a little success in Venus, that reopens that up. Maybe somebody else who decides, okay, it's time to really get back to this kind of, is sirolimus the next advantage in BTK therapy? Clearly it was an interesting debate for a few years there about paclitaxel. And while paclitaxel came out okay and is back on the market, there was a key component, which is it doesn't get any incremental reimbursement. And so moving to the next drug with a different way to deliver it and placing the indication on the drug itself really affords us not only a unique delivery opportunity, but a unique reimbursement opportunity too.
Got it. Got it. That's helpful. And before we kind of go back in time and learn a little bit more about the past 10 years at Mercator, just to understand that the Venus play. So I spent a little bit of time in this space, right? So I'm just trying to think through how this is used. So a patient thrombosis, they've got a DVT, vascular surgeon, interventional radiologist, maybe an interventional cardiologist is going to intervene. How is this used? Is the clot removed first, and then you're using the bullfrog to sort of I guess help prevent further thrombosis? Is that kind of, generally speaking, the sort of the idea?
Yeah,
Yeah.
there's a ton of literature and nobody really dug it up until we got going on this,
Okay.
showing that DVT is really associated with inflammation and thrombus begets more inflammation, and then the intervention itself, can be fairly traumatic. And so is there, some inflammation associated with taking the thrombus out and opening the vein? The real, what's left there, right? Because obviously there's been, new age thrombectomy is cranking, and those guys have done a great job and, reestablished this, found a way to really capitalize on the big DRG that was sitting there and then fine-tune the technology and maybe, get patients in and out of the hospital quicker and, do it without lytic therapy per se. And so, but what hadn't happened is there hasn't been a lot of improvement in just, hey, if you open the vein up and the patient does fine, he does fine, but a pretty big percent still go on to have post-thrombotic syndrome. And we believe that's really biological in nature. That's an inflammation of the vein that you're not really treating by just opening the vein. And so, just like anti-proliferatives were stopping cell proliferation on the arterial side, we're really trying to quell that inflammation associated with the initial DVT event, associated with these devices that mechanically open the vein up. And then even for patients who, depart from the hospital and don't go on their anticoagulative therapy, they're not very medical compliant, we're providing, a safety net to really change and try to maintain normalcy of the vein. Veins have a lot of capacitance. They can both fill and empty, so to speak, which becomes really paramount. As you're trying to move that blood up the column, the reason the valve's there is, with no valve, it's a heavy workload, right? And so similarly, if the vein loses its ability to fill and empty, that's really what leads to, in our minds, these post-thrombotic syndrome and these ailments that really go with the progression of the disease that, once it's the genie's out of the bottle, it's really hard to treat. And so we're trying to maintain vein normalcy along with the DVT intervention, if that makes sense.
It does. It does. And I think for those listening that aren't familiar with post-thrombotic syndrome or PTS, it's very, very prevalent, and it can be nasty, right? To live with, So
Completely debilitating, right?
yeah,
It's
100%.
swelling and itchiness and soreness and lack of mobility. And, it's very well graded. And we've been building a data set there that shows we are making a really big dent. So we're excited about that.
Yeah, no doubt. That's cool. Well, let's spend the next, 20, 30 minutes kind of going back in time and learning a little bit more about your journey with Mercator. And really feel free to kind of layer in previous experiences as well. And I'd really like to kind of hone in on kind of how your thoughts as it relates to kind of, you know, moving through early stages of development, but then also would like to kind of touch on definitely your approach to clinical studies, kind of clinical roadmaps in general, because clearly that's, you know, that's a wheelhouse of yours. And then I definitely want to allocate a little bit of time towards talking about fundraising, you know, because you've been around a while and been able to kind of keep, not only keep the company flow, but yet still been, you know, it's still cranking on a lot of clinical work, it sounds like. So curious to kind of learn about your journey there. But let's start with early stage development. Bullfrog's a great example of a platform technology, but I'm sure it looked a lot different, right, back in 2014, 15, 16 than it does now. And it's off. This is, you know, very challenging for a lot of medtech entrepreneurs. Is like you don't have a lot of capital. You know, you don't have endless resources, but you're trying to kind of get to the next inflection point, get to the next milestone with your development in those early years. So, when you think about kind of that process, what do you, you know, how do you coach up right other you know, medtech, you know, founders and CEOs through those early years?
Yeah, you know, I can speak to kind of our experience here. I think, like you said, it's been one that, you know, evolved over a much longer course of time than most people have. You know, the device has been around much longer than just the time I've been here. It was initially conceived as a coronary drug delivery device, and it came out of the Berkeley School of Engineering. The chief science and technology officer here is the founder of the company. I'm very fortunate to have him as a partner. You know, Kirk Seward is really, you know, super creative guy. Most people, when they see the Bullfrog, you know, the initial reaction is that's a very clever device. And so, you know, but it started on a, you know, it was going to be a coronary product. So it was on an 014 rapid exchange platform. I don't know if all of your listeners will go that far back, but it was really designed for something that's completely different than now. And so as that product really migrated over to peripheral, because coronary DES was so successful, there wasn't really a chance to come back at that at the time. And so, you know, you can imagine all the standard iterations that you're thinking about, right? 014 to 018 to ultimately 035 on the venous side. You know, we want to increase the needle length. We want different balloon sizes, you know, to fill different vessel sizes, you know, more push, more torque, all these things, right? And so I guess what I would say is you usually don't get everything, you know, right out of the gate. And so you constantly have this list, and at the appropriate times, whether it be you're updating your 510K or whether it's a new opportunity, you know, you try to incorporate those things along the way. So, you know, all of that I think is relatively straightforward and probably things that, you know, med tech CEOs have their arms around and think about. You know, one thing that happened here early was the 510K approval on this device, and it's a very broad indication, right? It's for delivering, you know, diagnostic and therapeutic agents to, you know, peripheral and coronary vessels. I mean, it's almost so broad that, you know, what was the FDA, you know, what were they doing when they issued such a broad device? And then as we work with each drug, you know, we're trying basically to get a new indication that we can fold into the device label, you know, on a specific drug. I will say that, you know, not knowing, you know, how long some of this stuff is going to take, you are kind of pitted with a, hey, what's the optimal device versus, you know, what's the optimal outcome that you're trying to show? And I do think you have to have some clarity. This will probably sound like a truism, right? But you're balancing these things off against each other. And for us, it was, you know, maybe a slightly imperfect device. A lot of times you're not focused in the device world on real ergonomics and ease of use until, you know, later in the stage. You know, our goal was to get a device that we could complete the study work with and show that the drug actually did what it was supposed to do, right? It met the unmet need that's left in whatever peripheral vascular intervention we were in. And so we were spending, you know, the clinical research is expensive. We've spent a lot of money, you know, building data sets. I feel like we've done a good job. They're published, they're peer reviewed. They're actually peer reviewed in the same places that the drug coated balloons are. You know, I mean, there was a real lift there, but those are trade-offs, right? I mean, you're trading off imperfect device for, you know, does the concept. And so there's always those balances, I think, particularly in clinical development of, you know, you might not have the end all be all product, but if you've got the right outcome teed up, then you'll always be able to come back and continue to refine the device.
Yeah, and that's really, really good feedback. It's something that comes up, you know, fairly often. A lot of other, you know, experienced, you know, founders and CEOs like yourself have kind of raised this up as like when you're moving through those early stage development efforts, there's always a tendency to like add on like that one more feature or those two more features, right? And the ability to kind of filter out the noise and keep that kind of that core objective in mind, like this is what we want to do at this phase, and we've got to really kind of almost eliminate everything else at this point. In retrospect, it's easy, right? But in the heat of it, it's like right. It's oftentimes really, really challenging to make those decisions.
Well, if some of the things I say sound cliche, I don't mean for them to be, but you're mm-hmm. right. I mean, it's so hard, you know, in the heat of the battle and at the moment to know when to step on the gas and when not to. You know, maybe an example here is we had a 510K really, really early on, and yet we've been in clinical development forever. I'm not saying I know the answer, but there's a lot of expense with maintaining a 510K and a CE mark when you're not commercially viable and you're only in clinical study. And so, you know, looking back, I haven't done the analysis, but, you know, it is interesting, right? You know, were those dollars that, you know, were spent right? And it almost sounds blasphemous because everybody wants the 510K or the CE mark when you can get it. I'm just simply pointing out that pre-commercially, they're expensive to maintain. And so those are kind of questions you wouldn't anticipate or thoughts you wouldn't anticipate, but it's really interesting.
Yeah, no, that's a really great topic. I'm glad you brought that up, right? Because the natural inclination, I think, for every, you know, founder or CEO is to get to that clearance or get to that, well, in most cases, 5K clearance, but, you know, in some cases, I guess it may be PMA, but get there as soon as possible. But if there's not a sort of an immediate kind of commercial kind of, roadmap, you're going to be stuck in this kind of limbo land, right? Where you're having to maintain.
Well, there's definitely expense associated. I can confirm that.
Yeah, no, that's good. And I guess, you know, kind of circling back around to these decisions, right? Around early stage development and what to prioritize, et cetera. I guess, yes, they can sound cliche, but maybe the important message, I guess, for those listening is, oftentimes they're going to be hard. I mean, it's rarely that like a decision is just super easy to make. In some instances there will be, but most of the time it's going to be trade-offs, right? And they're not going to be the easiest trade-offs to make. And so I think that's maybe the largest take-home message, that if you're in this same boat, right, where you're trying to make hard decisions, just know they're going to be hard, right? And
yeah.
It's not like all of a sudden one day you're going to land on some aha moment where it's like, oh, it's this is the easiest decision in the world. It's just tough, right? That's it.
Yeah, I would say, exponentially with a novel device, right? Mm-hmm. If there's not a beaten path and it's well-known and very straightforward, it becomes more complicated. And, you know, you should build in a little bit more patience, a little bit more introspection, you know, and, you know, be prepared. I think it does behoove you, if you have clarity, and you know where you can be aggressive, great, be aggressive. But with novel devices, you know, there's going to be surprises along the way. There's going to be challenges along the way, you know, because those paths can take different turns. And then, you know, at the very least, people can move the goal line on you at the last moment, right? Whether it's a regulatory goal line, whether it's an acquirer's goal line or an investor's goal line, you know, the pitfall of data is once you start down a data trail, you know, more is always better, right? And so how do you make sure you've provided enough to actually close down your milestone and don't get wrung out for more and more and more?
Yep. That idea of the goalpost constantly shifting, so critical, right? And I, obviously you need to be sort of aiming towards some sort of milestone, some sort of like goalpost. But if your plan is completely rooted and baked and there's not optionality, or there's not a plan B or a plan C in the event that those goalposts shift, like maybe you want to kind of rethink that approach. Cause oftentimes, you know, they do shift, right? And whether it's more clinical data or more revenue, right? I mean, it's everyone wants more, right? That should be the default reality, I think, in most scenarios. Let's shift a little bit towards clinical work, right? And you obviously have a lot of experience with kind of building out roadmaps, strategy around the buildup of scientific evidence, not just at Mercator, but, you know, in previous roles as well. So with that said, it may potentially maybe a little bit easier for you, but it's often kind of a daunting thing, you know, for most entrepreneurs to kind of stare down. It's like it's super expensive. It can be nuanced. How does that ladder up to kind of the reg approach, et cetera? You know, are there, when you think about kind of this, you know, this kind of in general, kind of building that out, right, from scratch and thinking, you know, thinking about that clinical pathway, what are a couple, you know, pieces of advice that you oftentimes are recommending, right, to other you know, entrepreneurs that are earlier in their careers? Hey everyone, let's take a quick break to talk about Fastwave Medical, the company I co-founded and lead as CEO. Our team is developing next generation intravascular lithotripsy systems for complex calcific disease. This type of therapy is often referred to as IVL. The market size for IVL is over $9 billion, and there's only one player in the space with a market cap of around $10 billion. So naturally, there's a lot of investor interest in Fastwave. In fact, we opened up an opportunity to invest directly into the company almost a year ago, and we were blown away by the interest from our community. So much so that we ended up closing $8 million from our supporters in less than a month. Typically, opportunities to invest in venture-backed startups like Fastwave are pretty rare, so based on significant and continued demand, we highly encourage you to sign up for our waitlist to avoid missing out on the next opportunity to invest. You can opt in at fastwavemedical.com/invest. And if this is the first time you're hearing about Fastwave, here are some key highlights. As I mentioned before, we are sitting on an IVL market valued at over $9 billion with only one incumbent. Second, we just completed our first in-human study with 8 treated patients, resulting in 100% lesions crossed and a 93% reduction in mean diameter stenosis from baseline. We've raised over $20 million to date from corporate venture and cardiovascular KOLs, and we have 5 granted patents by the USPTO and multiple FTOs. If you're interested in empowering physicians with advanced IVL technology while potentially benefiting from a fast-growing IVL market, head over to fastwavemedical.com/invest and check out the details. Again, that's fastwavemedical.com/invest. All right, let's get back to the rest of the conversation.
Yeah, well, I think nowadays you definitely need to plan on some need for data, right? And so, you know, straightforwardly and easy, you might need data just to get your indication. But even beyond that, you know, whether it's data for reimbursement, whether it's data for improving reimbursement, whether it's data for improving payer coverage, you know, I mean, you're probably looking at some component of generating some clinical data. You know, it's easy to back down levels of data. You know, obviously, if you can get by with registry data and you're in a fast moving market and there's some reimbursement already associated and you're generating, you know, revenue while you're generating data, I mean, okay, awesome, right? You know, that's great. Then you get down to, you know, one-sided data. Maybe the commercialization is going to be harder and, you know, you at least need a data set to lead on. So if you can get away with one-sided data, great, you know, less expensive, you know, easier to enroll, these kind of things. And then, it, you know, getting to the more challenging where you might actually need randomized data to actually garner an FDA approval, or, you know, sometimes in a novel device like ours where, you know, you really want to show, you know, what a control group looks like and what a control group data set looks like. You know, then it in something that hasn't been done before in drug delivery in venous, for example, really super important to have, you know, randomized controlled data. And so there's some benchmark. Otherwise, it's too speculative and people don't really know, you know, kind of, you know, what the playground is. And so I think first and foremost, it kind of comes down to, you know, what's working in your favor. You know, is there a commercialization? Is there a reimbursement already starting to happen? I will say, you know, for companies with a little bit more complex clinical trial work in front of them, even if you have the opportunity to become commercial, if there's not a meaningful reimbursement, you're probably going to waste money. And you run the danger of, you know, people running out using the device for something that it wasn't your best shot on goal. And then you end up, you know, with out in the marketplace or a data set that ends up out there presented at a meeting that really doesn't behoove what you're up to. So we've really measured, you know, our commercial usage. You can buy our product. It's 510K approved. We don't sell it to just anybody. And it tends to go hand in hand with people that are doing a lot of clinical work who say, you know, look, I have a patient that doesn't fit in the study. They have a very great awareness of why they would want to use it commercially. And so it might sound funny, but you know, literally for 10 years, you have distributors chasing you down going, just give us your device. You know, it's got a CE mark. We want to sell it. And it's, you know, why it sounds great. You know, that there really isn't much upside in getting ahead of yourself commercially. You mentioned kind of this plateau and moving the goal line, whether it's on revenue or whether it's on clinical data. You know, they're both traps, right? You don't want to get caught in the plateau. And God forbid, you don't want to go backwards. And so, you know, there are those kind of considerations, depending on what you have or don't, that I think behoove you to understand. And again, be disciplined, be patient, you know, step on the gas when appropriate, but don't just step on the gas for the sake of stepping on the gas.
Yeah, that's a really good reminder. And that notion of getting to a 510K clearance, right, in this example, and commercializing, I think everyone would be like, yes, 100%. Let's absolutely do this. Revenue is king. Cash is, cash is king, revenue is queen, whatever, however you want to say that. But that's a really good point, right? I mean, once your device is out in the wild, like you could be going to the next conference and all of a sudden you see, you know, some study that's going to be presented on podium and it's like for some odd use. Yeah. You're like, things are a little bit less controlled for sure.
I guess treat your product, treat your market, treat your concept with care. You know, because some of those problems are hard to unwind or even come back from.
Yeah. Yep. That's good stuff. When you kind of on the same topic of clinical studies, you've been able to knock out, it seems like some more sophisticated clinical work than others. And I have a sense, you know, obviously without seeing your budgets, that you've been able to do it in a pretty efficient way, it sounds like. So yeah. when you think about this idea of do you manage this work internally, right? Do you manage it with kind of a curated group of external consultants, or do you go straight to a CRO, right? A well-known CRO. What's your typical approach to kind of like navigating those waters?
Yeah, we've really built most of it internally. I think we've been fortunate. You know, there are consultants that have come to us from, you know, CROs and longstanding experiences. I think we've paid a lot of attention and, you know, you're dialing into the data so hard and trying to make sure your own studies are going to meet the requirements that, you know, you really understand the clinical opportunity or the study opportunity in front of you. So I will say, you know, the more you can do yourself, if you can do it well, probably the better, at least the less expensive. You know, I won't get into a whole piece here on CROs. There are some great ones, but, you know, it's just not, they're not on the same time frame that you're on all the time. And, you know, certainly they don't have to be wed to the technology the way you have to be wed to it, to champion it through and, you know, to come to conclusions. So I think we've been fortunate. We've learned a lot along the way. We've gotten pretty good at it. We haven't had any real turnover in our clinical operations group. And so, you know, with no turnover and just becoming better and better at it, I think it probably really is a core competency for our company, is how to run one of these, you know, clinical trials that, you know, isn't just there, but actually makes it to publication, is scrutinized, and, you know, it becomes paramount. Once you put something out publicly and the outcomes have been published, you know, it can be really powerful. We're able to lean back on those things. The early work we did with dexamethasone on the arterial side, which never made it to the market commercially, helped pave a much faster way to get that same drug into the venous application. We had been to the agency about it. We had published data. It was in the public domain. And so, you know, those things became very valuable.
Yeah, that's good stuff. This topic of, you know, do you go on with a CRO? Do you build out that internal, you know, sort of core competency, as you mentioned? I remember a conversation I had with Osman Kwa, I believe is how you pronounce his last name. I'm going to murder it, but his Diality, I think, is the name of his dialysis company. You may know him, but we're talking about the same topic, and it's probably been over a year, maybe longer than that, maybe closer to 2 years now. And he was like, "Look, we kind of realized that like we wanted to lean into what we were really good at, right? Which is definitely more on kind of the technical kind of product building side, and you know, we just didn't have enough you know, again, core competency around how to effectively manage, you know, a clinical trial. So like they shifted a lot of those resources towards a CRO. And it sounds like, you know, based on your experiences, this is like kind of something that you know quite well, like you know how to do it. And so, you know, kind of leaning into that. And I think that's kind of what I'm hearing. And I think that's really good advice to any sort of function, right? I mean, if you're really good at something, like that could be your superpower, right? So take advantage of it. You know what I mean? So I think it's really good advice. But yeah, this topic though of like, again, I would wholeheartedly agree. Like, just like anything, there's really good CROs. There's not so good ones, et cetera. But in any regard, you're always going to care more about the thing, right, that you're working on versus, you know, versus working with external folks, right? So it's just a good reminder, I think, for anyone listening, whether you're outsourcing clinical work, outsourcing dev, outsourcing sales through a distributorship, et cetera, same thing applies, right? Like your care factor, your internal care factor is always going to be greater regardless of the sort of the initiative at hand.
So true.
Yeah. I'd like to jump to money, which kind of coincides with this topic, right? Of, you know, funding clinical work is not for the faint of heart, right? And it looks like you raised a Series D a handful of years ago. And I'm not sure if that was pre-COVID or not. But you're at that stage, right? You're raising that kind of money, I guess, just to kind of put this in perspective. And I know you've done a lot of this work through kind of what I would consider maybe atypical ways, right? Because most people would say, oh, Mercator raised a Series D. Who led it? What VC led it? And it sounds like you've been able to put together these tranches of capital with, you know, high net worth individuals, family offices, et cetera. So I guess if you want to start maybe high level on your approach to fundraising, but really I'd love to get your take really on working with, you know, smaller capital partners, right? In a sense, versus, you know, the typical you know, VCs that write larger checks.
Well, I guess, you know, since you put a moniker on it, a Series D, and I think the industry tends to do that, right? Mm-hmm. I think venture does that. But I will say there's more to it than that. And it tees up a great example for me. So yes, we raised what would be perceived as a Series D round. However, it was led by a Chinese strategic, corporate strategic. And really, they were approaching it, you know, at least half as a Series A. Because we, you know, that round incorporated a right to our product in mainland China for that particular investor. And so, you know, to them, it wasn't a Series D. They weren't doing a mezzanine round on a commercial round. And it allowed us, even though we're later in the development process, it really allowed us to raise the kind of capital we needed to keep going. And, you know, sometimes perception is not always, you know, accurate. It really wasn't a Series D. And so, you know, there are examples like that. I will say, you know, in terms of, you know, Series A all the way up to, you know, more commercial growth stage capital, right? It's great if you know who you are and you know what audience to approach. I mean, there are clearly investors that only want to invest in Series A work, you know, or very early work, right? And maybe even before that. I mean, there's obviously angel investors who like to get involved even before that. And so I think it really behooves you for not wasting time to really try to get some grasp on this landscape. And if you haven't done it before, it'd be really nice if they sold a map, you know, down at the store and you could just kind of let, okay, I'm over here in this corner. Trust me, it's not out there. And so, you know, but if you're Series A and you're talking to Series A folks, you're really maximizing your time and your efficiency, and then vice versa, right? I mean, if you're really looking for growth capital, which everybody seems to want to be investing, and yet very few opportunities are kind of sitting on the verge of, you know, a big commercial ramp, you know, at least know who you're talking to, because if you're going to go way down the path with somebody who's really interested in growth equity and, you know, really wants to fund a true Series D, and you're not a Series D, you're probably wasting your time, and you're going to put a fair amount of time in because nobody cuts you off immediately. And so you end up spending time on things that don't make sense. And then I guess I would say, you know, we've been pretty successful. We have a large family office presence here. And so there is family office money out there. This, again, is a great big broad category. Don't get sucked into just family office. If you're in med tech, there are relatively few family offices that understand med tech. Make sure that somebody has a doctor involved, whether it's a doctor that helps look after the fund, whether they're formally part of the fund or the family office. But if you're talking med tech and you're not talking to a physician who really understands what you're looking at, it's probably not going to be very productive time. And so, you know, I really think there are nuances to this, but, you know, there's obviously there's, you know, venture capital changed after 09, and now it's even changed again more. You know, there's not a lot of funds that are out there to do the $2 or $3 million round, you know, and get you, you know, a year down the road. Those are few and far between. And so, you know, if you can, through a network, identify in folks that actually make those kind of investments, you're way ahead. I think cold calling family offices and trying to line them up and spend time and only to find out that, you know, they know very little what you're talking about and the reality that they're going to make that investment in the face of an AI investment or, you know, some other super sexy investment becomes challenging. And so I don't know exactly how you do that, but to the extent you can really hone where you're going and know that you're on point, I think your time will be a lot better spent.
Yeah, no, I want to circle back around to your comment around this, the verbiage that we actually, you know, often throw at rounds of capital, right? Whether it's a series E or what seems to be a series E or D or whatever versus, you know, what it really is like. But such a great reminder and point really about knowing your audience. And, you know, it can seem really like when you're in the throes of fundraising, it can really seem exciting, right? People are responding to my emails, we're setting up meetings, but at the end of the day, you could just be wasting a ton of time, right? Yeah. Pitching endlessly to an audience that just is never going to pull the trigger, right? And maybe even just that signal that you mentioned earlier around family offices is like, is there any sort of like MD, PhD, like some sort of like science rooted or clinical rooted kind of figure and as that's part of this family office that, and if not, probably not. They're probably going to be in favor of investing in the next cool thing, right?
Well, AI as an example. A fast no is the second best alternative, right?
I mean, that's right.
I mean, obviously people know that, but can't emphasize it enough you know who you're talking to and try to get to that definitive, you know, critical juncture point of moving forward or not. But the more you can be on target, the better. And, you know, I know things like PitchBook are expensive, you know, but there's a lot of information and it really can help. You know, if you can get some limited access or, you know, somebody who does, or you can find ways to, like, you know, shave your list down and make sure it's as on point as you can get, it's only going to behoove you and your process.
Yep, no doubt. A fast no is not a bad thing at all. The slow maybes are what kill you. Absolutely kill you. But just to circle back around to your point, you know, series, you know, we often think of right seed to series A to series B, et cetera. But I think just it's good to know that like it doesn't always have to kind of be structured in that sort of fashion. I mean, it's good to kind of think about it in that sense if you're talking to, you know, more professional institutional investors, right? They're going to expect to kind of, you know, understand kind of, you know, that sort of lingo, that verbiage, that's oftentimes what they use. But, you know, if you need to raise $10 million and you think you're at a Series D round, that doesn't necessarily have to mean that you just invest with, you know, those type of investors that invest at that stage. It could look a little bit different. It could be a strategic, as you mentioned, right? That, you know, sees this as a little bit more of like an early stage investment, right? And they're going to use it, you know, for different, you know, they're going to invest for a different reason, right? So just good to remember to, you know, be flexible with that.
Well, and knowing your own model, knowing your own milestones, again, sounds a little cliche, but, you know, the temptation is, you know, you don't want to take any more money than you have to, you know, because you've got your next fundraising somewhere in the horizon, not too far down the line that you're envisioning. Mm-hmm. Obviously, you know, if you don't know well, or there's potential more unknowns in your equation, you know, look, you're better off to raise more money than less, right? And so you can get caught in these things with all kinds of unknowns, right? Whether it's the 08, 09, you know, financial meltdown, whether it's COVID. I mean, clearly we were impacted by COVID. You know, had COVID not come along, we believe we'd be done with a phase 3 randomized trial, Limus below the knee, and we'd be launching that product right now. That sounds like it would be very attractive. And so, you know, but look, COVID came along, you know, we found a way through it. We found a way to create value. And to the extent that you have, you know, those backup plans, and you have backup alternatives, or you can create them, you know, imperative to make sure. Sometimes it's just being around so that when the right thing finally does show up, you know, you're locked and loaded and you're ready to jump on it.
Yeah, 100%. Like if you're in the mix, right? Yeah. Dialed in into your kind of your ecosystem, your community. You don't know. I mean, you're gonna be much better positioned, right? In the event, to your point, Trent, that like if something does happen, if you get signals that are kind of, you know, forcing you to kind of, you know, pivot a little bit. You know, if you're not dialed in, if you're not in the mix, you're definitely less likely to see those. So with that said, I know we don't have a ton of time left. I'd love to jump to the rapid fire portion of the interview, but for everyone listening, again, it's mercatormed.com. That's the website. mercatormed.com. We'll link to it in the full summary piece on MedCider. We'll also link to Trent's LinkedIn profile so you can learn a little bit more about his background. And if you're new to MedCider, that's, you know, we do these podcast interviews, but do them in a little bit a different way in the sense that we construct sort of a longer form article that accompanies these podcast episodes. So if you're kind of leaning into this conversation and want to kind of go back and read the highlights versus, you know, re-listen to the interview, that's what those are for. So with that said, let's jump to the rapid fire portion of the interview. First question on the docket, Trent, is when you think about the next 12 months, right, for Mercator, take us through the end of 24, maybe into early 25. What are you most excited about?
Yeah, well, we started with a vision and an unmet need. You know, in DVT, and we've generated data now. So we actually have something to back it up. And, you know, we're excited. We've gotten that data out in front. And now it's really creating optionality, right? Investors want optionality. And so, you know, how do you, you know, is there corporate strategic interest? Is there venture interest? You know, is there family office or individual investor interest? You know, the financing mechanisms can run great, right? We've also been fortunate too. We've translated some of that that initial concept and some of the early data, you know, into NIH grants too. We've been scored very well on two NIH grants. And so, you know, I'm excited about trying to create the optionality that goes hand in hand with the work that we've done. I will say, if you're out early and you're trying to sell a concept as an investment, hey, we're headed in this direction, people pay attention, but, you know, the ability to actually close down, you know, is a foregone conclusion. People need to know that what you're doing is working. It's just so much more powerful.
Yeah, so true. You know, there needs to be some substance in kind of what you're pitching. There's no doubt. All right. Since taking on the CEO role at Mercator, you know, almost a decade in now, what's the most surprising thing that you've learned?
You know, I think reimbursement rules, right? Mm-hmm. You know, you can, like I said early in our discussion, you know, you can have very limited data. You can be in a part of the market where, you know, a Me Too product with reimbursement is really commercializable. And so you have to pay attention to the economics. You know, economics are everything. People get paid, you know, for using these tools. Hospitals are managing budgets. So, you know, and I'm speaking probably more to maybe your scientific founders. I'm not the traditional, you know, early stage med tech clinical development guy. When I got here, we thought because dexamethasone was a ubiquitous steroid and it was generic and you could pull it off any cart and we had an approval for the catheter, you know, there was better than a 50-50 chance that we weren't going to need to do clinical work. We could do some, but, you know, we wouldn't be forced to do any. And so, you know, I think for the engineering types who have a product and, you know, they've done good interaction with some early KOLs and they think they really have a spot on device, you know, understanding and really digging into the economics and how to time things around the economics, super important.
Really good stuff. To your point, we talked about revenue being king, but you know, economics, reimbursement, who's going to pay for it? Oftentimes the biggest hurdle to cross for above and beyond even reg and your regulatory pathway. So, all right. Next question, second to last question here is, let's presume you just presented to, you know, a group of life science entrepreneurs, maybe we're in the Bay Area, and you want to leave them with like one key take home message that they need to really understand to best position their venture for maybe ultimate success. What would that be?
Yeah, you know, I say you know, they've just got to have their homework done, right? And you can dream about having the right device. Get out, you know, really shop that around. And, you know, you probably need to go beyond KOLs. I mean, KOLs are always the fast adopters. They're always at the head of the field. You know, build in a few regular users too, right? I'm telling you, venture is now paying attention, right? They've been told by KOLs that things are going to be, you know, this is great. This is the next big thing. I think a lot of investors are now, you know, savvy and onto, let's make sure it's going to work and how quick it can work for the rest of the group, right? Mm-hmm. And these are questions that, you know, you have to field now and that you have to really be able to kind of validate along the way. Certainly everybody's, you know, appreciates and, you know, welcomes the support of the KOL. It's invaluable. It's incredible. But I would say, make sure that you haven't just built your device for a handful of people, but that the device is actually, you know, there for the mainstream in a reasonable period of time. These are things you may have to prove out so that, you know, the uptake can be as guaranteed as the initial interest factor from, you know, people that are really at the front end of things.
Yep. Aim for that middle of the bell curve, or at least have that in mind, you know, as you move forward. All right. Last question. Starting over in your late 20s, is there something that you'd whisper in the younger Trent's ears from a professional standpoint?
Yeah. You know, I'm happy with how my career's progressed. I would say, you know, one of the things that's surprising to me when you're in your 20s or anywhere in some of this adventure, you're very locked in on what your immediate objective is, you know? And so is everybody else. And maybe one thing that's hard to appreciate is, you know, just like you might be there in the next 15 or 20 years down the road, some of those same people that you're meeting with and that you're talking to and that you're working with will too. At the end of the day, the ecosystem is really small. Mm. And so I'm always surprised here as it's advanced along, you know, how many things triangulate back to things that you knew. So, you know, pay attention to your relationships, pay attention to the details along the way, because highly, highly likely that the, you know, it's a successful group of people in the industry are going to be the group that's there, you know, down the road. And, you know, relationships are everything and networks are everything. I mean, they're so important. And so, you know, pay attention to those, even, you know, as you're locked in and focused down, it's really good to have some awareness, you know, who's alongside of you, you know, who are the people you're interfacing with, and maybe not be mission critical on this mission. But the more you can be like, you know, if I'm going to see that person 10 years from now, does it change the way you behave or work with them? You know, I think it is an incredibly small world, and I'm not sure if you've experienced that, but that's a takeaway from, you know, one of the things that I've kind of observed over time.
Oh yeah, yeah. For everyone listening, we're recording this on Zoom as I normally do, and I'm nodding my head right to everything you're saying. Yeah. You know, in my younger years, I think any of us that are in startups are, you know, a bit on the ambitious side, right? And being mindful of the relationship, right? You don't get your way this time around, right? Just being mindful of what that relationship looks like, may look like in 5 to 10 years is just really, really, really good. Really good. Good thing to be thinking about. And don't underappreciate, I guess, if you're in your younger portion of your career. So, that said, Trent, I know we're late on, we're over schedule just a little bit here. So, again, for everyone listening, MercatorMed.com is the website. Definitely encourage you to check it out. And I think you mentioned this earlier, Trent, like anyone in this space, when you talk about like novel catheters, the Bulldog is usually kind of in the mix, right? And so it's a really, really cool technology. If you're in the arena or if you're kind of interested in this conversation or discussion, definitely encourage you to check out the device. And we'll, of course, link to it in the full write-up on MedCider for this particular conversation with Trent. So can't thank you enough for coming on the program. Really, really fun conversation, Trent.
Same to you, Scott. Thanks so much for having me. I really enjoyed it and look forward to staying in touch.
Yeah, I likewise. I don't have you hold on the line, but for everyone listening, thanks for your attention as always. Until the next episode of MedCider goes live, everyone take care. Hey, it's Scott again. One quick thing before you go. You see, I love bringing you insightful conversations with the best founders and CEOs of medical device and health technology startups. But here's the thing. I'd be super grateful if you could help me reach even more ambitious doers who share our passion. So if you found value in this podcast, If you found yourself nodding your head while listening, or if you simply enjoy what we're doing with MedCider, please take a moment to leave us a review. It's super easy. Just open your Apple Podcasts app or the podcast app of your choice, search for our show, and scroll down to the ratings and reviews section. Leave your honest thoughts and hit that 5-star rating if you think we're worthy. Your feedback is incredibly important, and it's the best way to ensure we keep bringing you awesome discussions with leading founders and CEOs. So take a moment to be a good friend and leave that review today. As always, thanks for being a part of our journey and for helping MedCider continue to grow and evolve. Your support is greatly appreciated. All right, enough talk about reviews. Stay tuned for another informative episode coming at you soon.